Hello, podcast listeners. We know podcasts are a great way to catch up on a program that you may have missed on KSJE, and it's provided as a free service of this radio station. But you know, KSJE is now listener-supported, and so while you enjoy this podcast, we hope that you'll also take some time to join KSJE. Become a member today. It's quite easy to do. Just go to our website at ksje.com/support and pick the level of support that best matches your budget. Thanks again for listening. Here's your podcast. Let me turn to my guest, who is here with me this morning to talk about his book, The Broken Circle. Rodney Barker is here. Mr. Barker, it's a pleasure to have you at KSJE. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for being here. And so for folks who are unfamiliar with your book, and I can't imagine anyone within the sound of my voice that is not familiar with your book, but this is a book that you wrote and spent about 3 years researching, and it was published in the 1990s, in 1993, about this time in Farmington's history in the 1970s when there were civil rights protests and unrest because of some long simmering issues in our community. Is that a good way to describe it?
Yeah, I'd say long simmering issues that broke out into a series of vicious crimes.
I think that's very accurate. Yeah, yes, sir. Right. And these crimes were basically the murder, any way to put it, of these young Navajo men by Anglo suspects and culprits, right?
By Anglo teenagers, yeah.
Yes.
At that particular time in Farmington, there was kind of a high school sport, if you will, kids to go out and to roll inebriated Indians for their hats, for their boots. And it was kind of a game they played.
And rolling meant beating them up.
Rolling was the phrase they used for that.
Right.
Sometimes it would get vicious. And in this particular circumstance, there was a series of murders of three Navajo men, and after they investigated it, they found it was three Navajo teenagers from Farmington High School who had done the killings.
You said Navajo, but I know you mean
Anglo. Oh, I'm sorry, three Anglo teenagers who had...
But that was the issue, yes, of course.
Sure.
And throughout then, the punishment and the trials and things like that, there were a lot of folks that felt that these perpetrators were not punished severely enough, right?
Well, yes. The issue was that they were 15 and 16 years of age, and by law, they could not be tried as adults. So the nature of the crime, the egregious nature, and we're not talking about just murdering. We're talking about torturing to death these men. So when the issue of whether or not we're going to put them on trial, how that trial is going to go, they had to be evaluated by psychiatrists and psychologists to determine whether or not they thought they could be rehabilitated. That was just the way the law was.
Right.
So the background to that investigation was we found the perpetrators, they evaluated them, they determined that at that age they could not say that they were incorrigible, that they could not be treated. So they ended up being sentenced to several years at Springer Boys School.
Right, for that rehabilitation, and then in the hopes that they could come back and become productive members of society.
That was the hope, yeah.
Right. And so your book, tell me the story about what brought you to write this book and what brought you to Farmington, because there is a story about that, I know.
Yeah, sure. I sometimes feel that my stories choose me, and this is a dramatic example of it. In 1974, when all this took place, I was living in Durango, and I was working as a freelance investigative journalist, writing for newspapers and magazines. I happened to come to Farmington one Saturday, oblivious to the history of what was going on, there was a parade coming down Main Street in Farmington, and I literally parked the car, got out, and started to see what was going on. I was going to go over hiking over in the Bisti, actually, basically walked into a riot, a street riot. Knew nothing of the background and the history. All I knew was that there was a confrontation going on between the police and what looked like a group of militant Indians on Main Street. And the next thing I knew, tear gas was flying, and I became wrapped up in the middle of that. Next thing you know, I was arrested. And it was while I was in jail sorting things out that I met several of the militant Indians who had been organizing and protesting, saying that they didn't feel the acts of these three kids was just isolated events. They felt that the town itself needed to be held responsible. And so that's why they had stepped out to interrupt this parade. So learning about that background as a writer, as a journalist, I thought there's an interesting story here. I talked to them, I met them, but it wasn't until about 15 years later that I came back to this story to decide to write about it.
Interesting. And so, and we've got some images to share with our viewers who are watching about this period of time, these historical images that that are really powerful to share and really take you back in time to those events, right?
Yeah, right. I mean, it's this was a photo archive put together by a photographer that ended up being exhibited at Stanford University, and he was a photojournalist, and he took pictures of the marches that were going on.
Bob Fitch is who
Bob
you're speaking
Fitch is his
of,
name,
right?
Yeah,
and we appreciate the use of these photos from his archive.
Yeah, I did. But for people who weren't here then, or who have a distant recall, these images do bring it back and make it alive.
Right, and I think for a lot of folks who are hearing us this morning, Rodney Barker, they can't imagine this town being the location of a protest, being the location of these heinous crimes happening, and things along that line. So it really is, I think, an education for folks to really go back to in that time. And this is a time in America when, in the 1960s, we saw civil rights protests throughout the country and riots in other American cities too. It wasn't that long after those.
Sure, and that's why I wrote the book. As I came back 15 years later, I mean, these events happened in 1974, and I didn't start researching and writing the book until the late 80s, and I guess I assumed that it would already be written, or there'd be something. I know it was covered in the newspaper, but like a lot of communities back in those 60s and 70s, there hadn't been someone to come in, sort of an official historian, if you will, talk to all different people, all different sides of the story, and take a look at it. And so I decided that was an opportunity for me to talk to all sides, be it the Native community, be it the Anglo community, be it the law enforcement community, and the challenges there, and to put it together so there would be an archival document that 25 years later, where we are now, people could look back on and learn about.
Right. And this incident got the attention of the federal government.
Sure. A Civil Rights Commission came in to look at the conditions, and they came out with a report after doing a series of interviews in the town and holding meetings. And they actually came back some 30 years later to do issue a report on a follow-up back in the early 2003, I believe it was. Has Farmington changed as a result of that? In what ways has it changed?
Exactly. And I think they did discover that hopefully things had changed for the better in those ensuing 30 years.
Yeah, they did. I mean, they said there were still areas of improvement, but by and large, a lot of changes, positive changes have been made. You know, it's that old line, if you don't learn from history, you'll repeat it.
Right.
And so be it my book, be it their report, this was a way for them, for people to sort of to learn from that so we don't fall inadvertently back into that same kind of situation.
Sure. And what do you say to people who say, but shouldn't we just not worry about these negative things? It really casts our town in a negative light, and we want to move beyond that, Rodney Barker. Why do you pull this stuff back up and write about it?
Well, I mean, I think there's the assumption that, you know, well, if it happened once, it can't happen again. And I felt that's not necessarily true at all. And I just felt that a document like this was something people could refer to. Here I am today. I mean, was it happened in 74. We're talking 40.
It's awfully early for me to do math, but I'm going to try. Long time ago, yes.
40-some years.
Yes, sir.
But it's something that is being taught. I mean, it's being taught not just in Farmington, but at other – I've been contacted by a number of college courses on cross-cultural conflicts and how they're handled and how people can learn from that. So the book has made a contribution beyond Farmington.
Right. And I would think, too, that Farmington, even though that's the focus of your book, but these issues are raised in other communities all across the country, all across the world.
Yeah, after the book came out, I was contacted by a number of writers from back east. Actually, the Washington Post in particular is one where the fellow had read my book, and he was going to go down. It wasn't to Selma, but was one of the communities in the South that had been racked by civil rights violence, to go down into that community and to try to do the same kind of thing. Not just to dig things up, but to try to provide a healing experience for people that would be there for people to refer to later on.
Sure. And it really, this book and the issues that the book brings up brings discussions about discrimination and how we treat each other and how we treat people of other cultures and other ethnicities to the forefront.
Yeah. At the time, there was a young militant group who were university educated who were familiar with what was happening in the rest of this country and who wanted to use this as an example, Farmington as an example. They felt that Farmington was a community that had, in its own ways, tolerated discrimination against Native Americans. They wouldn't have approved of these kind of things, but it created an environment in which individual kids who were disturbed in their own way could project their particular anger and aggression towards Native Americans, and did.
Right. And so we see this protest, and you mentioned that this was the one that you saw was during a parade that was then interrupted by these protests, but it's my recollection that there were some regular protests then afterwards. Is that true?
Oh, yeah. They followed up.
Yeah.
I mean, part of the enjoyment of the book for me was to research the whole evolution of a group of local militant. I say militant. I mean, they were educated in Navajo, feeling their way through this process.
But they weren't just going to sit back and write letters or have conversations at a conference table. They wanted to take action.
Well, and there wasn't full disclosure. I mean, the idea that from the Indian point of view, you have these three kids who committed these heinous crimes, and the next thing you know, they're being sent off to boys' school. That didn't seem like justice was being done. And so if you tolerate that, it could be repeated. It's not taken seriously. So they felt the town was not taking these crimes seriously enough. That's why they wanted to put the town on trial. That was their perspective. From the town point of view, hey, you know, we don't approve this. And the town was very defensive about that. And at the time, was Marlo Webb was the mayor. And so he cooperated with me in the book. And it was very interesting hearing his particular point of view. He was a new mayor. He had the Chevrolet dealership in town. Now he becomes the mayor, and he inherits this problem. So it was interesting for me to talk to him about somebody who felt responsible for the town. There are these horrible crimes. He's being held accountable. How does he handle it as well, too?
Right. But the mayor has no power over the judicial system and how these boys were prosecuted.
And the judge in the case didn't say why these went to boys' school. The records of the examinations of the kids were not revealed at the time. So this is not a book, or any kind of a full accounting could have not have been written at that particular time. Time had to pass.
Sure. And I imagine there were calls for boycotts and things like that. And certainly Farmington is very dependent on the Navajo Nation and the Native American people for economic prosperity in town.
Yeah, I had the privilege of sitting in on some of the discussions dealing with the I shouldn't call it the militant Indians, but they were the native community that was not going to sit still for this, and that wanted to have change, and felt that this was an opportunity to discuss various ways that they could affect change. One of the things that was considered was an economic boycott, because they wanted their grievances to be taken seriously.
Right. The pictures, again, that you shared with me and that we're sharing with our viewers are showing a little bit about the police response. And here's a shot of a line of police officers that are maybe in front of a more residential part of town to maybe contain whatever was going on to the downtown area and not have it spread throughout the city.
Yeah. And again, Farmington had not experienced anything like this before.
Right.
Most communities that have been shaken up by civil disobedience have not had experience like that. So it's learning as you go.
Sure. Well, and these were in bigger places like Chicago, and Los Angeles, and New York, right? Yeah. Not Farmington, New Mexico.
Right, right. What was unique here, of course, is it's a Navajo reservation border town, and the issues of the juveniles and how they could be, whether they should be held accountable. And then, again, there was a sort of, the boys were sent out of town. This a parade that I was arrested at was a Saturday, the day before, literally the day before. The judgment had come down that the boys would not be tried as adults, but as kids, and they were taken out of town to Springer. So this was the very next day. So it was a hot time.
Right. And of course, in this time, you know, these days with social media, we think that things happen very, very quickly. But back in the 1970s, for something to get organized and happen the very next day, that shows a lot of get out and talk to people and gather people and make this happen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it did. It's a fascinating story on a lot of different levels. And I will say that there are people who have heard about the book and have formed a judgment about it, and to which I just say, please read the book and then let's have a conversation.
Sure.
Because I really went a lot of effort to be fair to everybody, to sort of so you understand their point of view, where they're coming from, be it the Indian, the non-Indian point of view as well.
Right. We have a comment on on Facebook, Mr. Barker. They're talking about being at Farmington High School in the mid-90s and still talking about rolling Navajos on Friday nights. How disappointing is that?
Well, I mean, yeah. I mean, race relations in a border town are not something that are going to be done away with. It's a matter of managing it. And so, yes, they're going on. As I said before, I came here today. I did my homework and did some research, and part of that was looking at accounts in newspapers and talking to different people. I'm told it's still going on. Not that there are deaths going on there, but that sport, that there are reckless kids out there doing these kind of things. The phrase "after dark" was used before, and just a few years ago in Albuquerque. You had several incidents here at which men in a parking lot, a couple of kids going by here and beating them up and deaths resulting. So it's an ongoing problem. It wasn't solved by what happened back in the 70s.
Right, as much as we wish it was, but it's not. And the fact that these things still happen, and again, I think for leaders and for politicians and other folks from both sides need to be aware of these things that may be still happening in our communities, and not avoid it, not try to bury it, but to address it face on.
And let me say, in my research before I came back, I mean, Farmington has done a lot of good things to try to control the problem. Is it still there? Can they control everything? Not at all. But I have to say that one of my hopes when I wrote the book was that Farmington would not move into denial about it, but that actually there was an opportunity here for it to be a community that could show how it respond to these situations and be an example of positive healing for other communities as well, too. And I think there are aspects of what's happened in Farmington other communities could look to and learn from.
Right. And I know, I think law enforcement and politicians and others, I think, are very aware of the past and also what bubbles kind of under the surface, that we are just an incident away from perhaps another similar situation if it's not handled properly. Would you agree
absolutely,
with that?
Absolutely. And that's where, I mean, at the time, the names of these kids, I mean, were in public, just their ages, 15 and 16.
Right. Well, they were juveniles, and those weren't.
Understandable about that. But when I did investigations into their background and the individual family circumstances they grew into, these were disturbed kids. This played out. And who did they target? They targeted people that they didn't, one kid called them subhumans. And they inebriated Navajo, making themselves vulnerable, making themselves targets like that. When kids have problems, they're going to go after the disadvantaged. They're going to go after the weak. They're going to go after the people who they think less of. So that's why I went into the background like I did to see where these kids were. And that's fascinating stories. And then what happened to them after they got out of Springer?
That was going to be my very next question, because I know a lot has been said about these boys, and that that they may have gotten their just desserts because of what they did.
Well, that's kind of what brought me back to the story. It was some 15 years later. I was at an art show, actually, on Palm Springs, and I'm walking to this hotel, and the artists had different rooms. And I went into a room, and there was a fellow there, and he had pictures of shiprock all over the walls, and got into a conversation, and he says, "Are you familiar with the Four Corners and shiprock?" I said, "Yes, I have." And he said, "Well, I'm from Farmington. Are you aware of Farmington?" This is 15 years after I'd been arrested, right? I said, "Yeah, I had my experience with Farmington too," and I mentioned that I had gotten arrested, and he said to me, "Oh, did you hear what happened to the three kids who did the killings?" And I had not followed up, so I said, "No, I didn't." And he said, "A Navajo shaman put a curse on them, and they're all dead." I had not heard that. I didn't know if it was true, but that triggered that triggered me sort of coming back and doing my own research to find out about that. So that started me down the road that ended up with a broken circle.
Interesting. And of course, those three men, those boys who turned into men, grew into men, did not have really happy lives, it seems to me.
And that's what's really interesting, how their fates played out. If you will, ceremonial recourse that the traditional members and family members of the victims tried to bring about justice when they felt that white man's justice hadn't worked.
Right. The book, again, The Broken Circle, it was published in 1993, mm-hmm. And it's still available, I know, for folks.
It's an e-book on Kindle.
Okay. And but it still has, and there was talk back in those days about a film, about a movie. I asked you about this before we came on the air this morning, and you tell me that that's still a possibility.
Well, I mean, yes. I mean, when the book first came out, it was optioned by a couple of fellows who did a film with Robin Williams called The Dead Poets Society, involving kids there. It went through several scripts. It was optioned several times, and they just couldn't find the right way of telling the story. And so that option lapsed. Over the years since then, I've been approached several times by people who wanted to make a film. And there was one group that I got ahead of themselves. Ahead of their skis, I think is the term these days.
Right.
Without having an approved script by me or the rights, I heard they were even coming to Farmington and announcing a film was going to be made, which is really unfortunate. And I tried to shut that down as quickly as I could. But I still think there are cinematic possibilities, and I think it's a story that I deserves to be told in a variety of forms. And visually, cinematically, the right filmmaker comes along, I think it could be a powerful tale.
You'd be open to exploring that.
With the right producer, with the right team, absolutely.
Very good, very good. In the minutes we have remaining this morning, Rodney Barker, you're here today to speak with me, but not just for that, but you are going to talk at Leadership San Juan later on today on their Multicultural Day as part of a panel, mm-hmm. Because of the work that you have done with your book and what you've been telling us this morning. But what's next for you? What have you been doing recently? What are you going to be doing? Is there going to be another book coming out? Is there other things that interest you about this area?
As Ernestine said, yes. When you write a book that receives the kind of attention that mine did, you get approached by a lot of people. And so over the years, I've sought out different stories that I was interested in. A number of them haven't panned out. I just finished a book. A doctor got a hold of me, and he was addicted to opioids. And he had a doctor. And he had a very, very dramatic story. I've been interviewing him and talking to him. And it goes in completely unanticipated directions. So I'm working on that particular story. I look for topical stories to write.
Right. And so obviously you stay very busy.
Yeah, I have stayed busy.
Very much so.
I still live in the Southwest here, though.
Good. Very good. Mm-hmm. Well, it's been fascinating to have you here this morning. I can't thank you enough for taking some time to come in and talk with me about this very important time in our community's history. And again, to hear you say that you can see some improvements, I think is good, because you saw the town at its very worst.
Yeah.
And I'm hoping you can see it at its
absolutely.
Little bit better.
Let me say that after the show here this morning, I'm going to be speaking at Rosanate School.
Right.
And there have been some teachers up there who've been very progressive in having their students read The Broken Circle and then communicate directly to me. And I've gotten some wonderful messages from people, students who've read the book, what it meant to them, and then commenting it too. So, I mean, the whole community, talking with you, Scott, meeting with Rosanante, being part of the leadership, I'm glad to be back.
Well, it's great to have you back. And again, it's important, I think, for everyone in the community to know about our history. The good, the bad, the ugly, all bits and pieces of it, because you really can't learn from it unless you really understand it.
That's right. And if you don't learn from it, you'll repeat it.
That's true. And we don't want to do that.
No.
So, Rodney Barker, pleasure. Thank you for coming in.
Thank you, Scott.
You're very welcome. Author Rodney Barker, my guest here of The Broken Circle, my guest on KSJE. And I'll be back with more in just a moment, everyone. The time right now is 8:36. Did you enjoy that podcast? We hope that you did. And if you did, share it with your friends. And if you really want to keep podcasts like this coming, please support KSJE. You can do it easily online at ksje.com.